snob zones, animal testing, and making absinthe.
It certainly isn't one of those things that you would have expected to happen to you.
It's a special look back and a chance to say goodbye. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. It feels like this show has been part of my life forever, but the fact is it's only been about 7 years. During that time, I've been lucky enough to speak with amazing guests discussing politics, the environment, the economy, actually just about everything, because every issue is a women's issue. And it's been an honor to feature the views of some fascinating women on a wide variety of important topics. But everything changes eventually. This week, because it's my last show as producer and host, I'd like to revisit some of my favorite interviews with you. First, Lisa Prevost, author of the book Snob Zones. In it, she talks about communities in New England that have effectively created restricted towns through zoning and high real estate prices. But she says they're discovering being exclusive comes at a cost that isn't just about money.
I mean, let's talk about Roxbury, the town in Litchfield County that I write about. Was a farm community, gradually became a destination for wealthy New Yorkers, beginning with Arthur Miller. And over time, you know, those people had the money to help set aside land, which made the town all the more attractive. And of course, if you already lived there, it was great. You know, you had these people setting aside land for you and your town wasn't changing. But now, because they've continually upzoned so that now you need a minimum of 4 acres to build a house, almost everywhere in town, you know, the people who can live there are pretty much wealthy people. And so what's happened is that Roxbury is now one of the oldest towns in Connecticut by median age, and they constantly are in a scramble to get enough volunteers to round out their firefighting force and to staff all the town committees. And in fact, you'll see great overlap between different committees, same people serving on two or three committees. And also their school enrollment is projected to plummet over the next decade because they don't have the young families. So they're going to be paying a lot of money for their elementary school with fewer kids.
So are we looking at a future where there are simply communities that most people will not have access to and the rest of us will be confined to other areas?
Well, I would say we're already there in many parts of the Northeast. I mean, where I live down in Fairfield County, I mean, that's almost where we're at, where, you know, what we call middle class here might be a little bit higher than other parts of the country, but we have great concentrated poverty in our cities in Connecticut and great affluence in the suburbs surrounding those cities. We have great disparities in educational achievement between the cities and the suburbs, and great disparities in income. So are we headed there? I think we're already there, you know, only in a lot of places. And you could say the same about parts of Massachusetts. Not so much New Hampshire, but I would say definitely Massachusetts and Connecticut. Now, there are some trends that could help turn this around a little bit. One being that we have the baby boomers now going into retirement, and some portion of them will want to downsize, so they'll be looking for smaller housing types. And we also have the millennials coming up who have been shown in various surveys that they really don't want the big house on the big tract of land. They might want their own house as opposed to an apartment, but they are more interested in walkable living close to town. So that would necessitate smaller types of housing. And then there's also the trends in energy prices, which makes it more expensive to heat houses, more expensive to drive a long ways. So all of these things together should the market allow it, will kind of drive up demand for these smaller housing types.
Lisa Prevost is the author of Snob Zones. Find out more at lisaprevost.com. Another issue that pits common sense against artificial constraints is animal testing. The EU banned the sale of cosmetics that are tested on animals, and India has now followed suit. And China, which requires animal testing for cosmetics, is dropping that requirement. There are proposals to ban animal testing in the U.S. Dr. Pascaline Clerk is Senior Director of Animal Research Issues for the Humane Society of the United States.
It's very hard to convince the public opinion that you don't need animal testing to prove that a product is safe, but there are alternatives right now that exist and that companies have developed and that have been approved to be used to do the exact same type of testing that are done on animals. And it's proven that those tests give results that are as good, if it's not better, than what we get from animal testing.
And I'm assuming it's a very large industry that supports this animal testing. Is that where most of the argument comes from? Simply it cuts off an industry that doesn't want to be cut off?
Oh yes. I mean, can you imagine if you tell to like big corporation that starting tomorrow they cannot test an animal and then we'll have to work on, adopting new techniques? It's going to be a big change in Europe in March. So the European Union is voting on a ban of cells of cosmetics that are tested on animals. They already had a ban on, basically they were not able to produce any cosmetic and test them on animals, but now they won't allow any cosmetic coming from foreign countries to be sold on the European market. So the European Union will become in March the world's largest cruelty-free cosmetic market. So that will make a lot of companies think about animal testing, especially companies in the U.S. or in China, because they won't be able to sell their products in Europe anymore. So that will change the market and the landscape of the cosmetic industry.
Are there any products that absolutely must be tested on animals? Is there such a thing? If everyone adopts this, do we lose any kind of products, or is this simply, no, you do a different type of test?
You just do a different type of test. And, the Food, Drug, and Administration in the U.S. does not require animal testing to prove safety. So in the U.S., there is no agencies requiring animal testing. So there is, companies could use different ways and use alternatives to do the exact same job.
Okay, now let's do the stuff that nobody likes to talk about. What actually happens to the animals that are being tested? Why is it that we want to stop this?
So basically animals are restrained and companies and, will test products on their skin, so they will be shaved and they will pour products on their skin, they will pour products in their eyes, they will also make them breathe, but not in a very nicely way. They will basically stick a tube in their throat and make them inhale fumes from cosmetics. It's very cruel. There's no other way to describe this type of technique. So when you know that there are alternatives on the market that exist and will, end the suffering of animal, it's still very frustrating to see that, nothing is moving faster on the issue.
Dr. Pascaline Clerk is Senior Director of Animal Research Issues for the Humane Society of the United States. If you want a reliable list of cruelty-free products, go to leapingbunny.org. Coming up, an unexpected calling and a woman who helped create a better workplace for thousands of coworkers. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1299. I first became aware of Cheryl Lynn's when I saw a bottle of her absinthe on a store shelf in a local wine shop. She creates handcrafted absinthe, bourbon, and rye in rural Delaware County, New York, and drives her product in her pickup truck to stores from upstate New York to New York City. The bottles practically fly off the shelves. She used to work with computers, but her hobby took over her life.
I discovered you could buy a small little Portuguese alembic, a certain kind of still, copper still, that, 1 gallon capacity, minuscule really, over the internet for, a few hundred dollars. I thought, okay, well, let's give this a try. At the very least, I'll have something to play with.
And Cheryl, was that legal at that time?
No, distilling actually in the home is not a legal activity anywhere in the United States.
Oh, so you're a lawbreaker too.
I was, yes. There's actually a large number of people out there doing hobby distilling. I can't say millions, but certainly probably a few thousand out there. And, they have websites. So obviously, the TTB is well aware of them. But they're much more interested in having them go professional so they can collect tax revenues.
And what did make you make the leap to becoming a professional distiller?
Well, what happened there was, my experiments continued over about year and a half. And eventually, I was friends, it's like, we really don't like this absinthe you bring. These were the commercial brands that I had brought in from Europe, these. And I said, well, here, why don't you try mine? They said, oh, we like this. And I'm like, really? It was kind of a little bit of a revelation that actually I was making something that people liked. And I also had the opportunity to meet with some people who had gone to Europe in early 2006 to make absinthe commercially at a distillery in France. And it was kind of like a community of absinthe people. And they had a chance to try mine. They thought, well, Cheryl, perhaps you should be professional, which was a real revelation again to me. And by this time, absinthe had been, everybody says re-legalized, but none of the rules have officially changed. What happened was they reinterpreted what the term thujone-free might be based on modern chemical analyses. So that allowed absinthe to be reproduced here in America as well as brought in by legitimate importers.
No, repeat that to me because I didn't understand that. It has to be free of what?
Long ago in the 19th century, late 19th century, early 20th century, there was a lot of problems with alcoholism. But there really wasn't a definition of that. Even from a medical standpoint, they kind of knew that, yes, if you had too much alcohol, that was bad, but absinthe, being the strongest spirit on the market, was blamed because it was hugely popular. They were able to determine that there was this chemical, thujone, that was present in one of the ingredients of absinthe, grand wormwood.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, well, this must be the cause. So in 1907, the Swiss banned absinthe, and following that, the Belgians. The U.S. in 1912, the predecessor to the USDA, the Agriculture Department, said, okay, we'll regulate this chemical. That pretty much ended absinthe in the U.S., and so that's where it languished for years. And in 2007, several manufacturers in Europe wanted to bring in absinthe that were totally legal in Europe, into the United States. And eventually they started approving some that were made here in the U.S. So this was part of all the history of absinthe kind of being reallowed in the U.S. and part of my the beginnings of my adventure in starting a distillery.
Cheryl, has it surprised you that you've discovered this thing that's basically consumed your life now?
It certainly isn't one of those things that you would have expected to happen to you? I always hated those questions in the interviews years ago. You know, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I certainly never imagined to be a craft distiller of anything.
Cheryl Linz is the owner of Delaware Phoenix Distillery in Walton, New York. Find out more at DelawarePhoenix.com. Gilles Malkin approached me a few years ago and wanted to know if a man was allowed to be part of 51%. Since then, he's generously contributed more than 50 audio profiles of amazing women in history. You may not know that Gilles is the son of legendary folk singer and political activist Sonia Malkin. This week, he profiles a woman who was a friend of his mother, a woman who helped protect thousands of women workers.
Rose Pesata was born in Doroznia, a tiny town in the Ukraine, in 1896. News of the existence of light bulbs first came to her as a doubtful rumor. Her parents were Jewish grain dealers, and her father, a bright man who, along with many others of his day, secretly dreamed of substituting the Tsarist system with one of a more democratic character. Rose's sister Esther wrote to her from the U.S., where she was doing fine as a seamstress in New York, and so Rose decided against the only other avenue open to her at home, a dull future as a housewife. She arrived in New York on the eve of Thanksgiving, 1913, and got a seamstress job through her sister. She joined Local 25 of the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union and began to understand the ins and outs of the world of women's labor. But she didn't stop there. She attended a summer program at Bryn Mawr on women workers in industry, then studied social science for 2 years at Brookwood Labor College in New York. Students and teachers from far and wide came to discuss labor law and the continuing movement to improve working conditions, and gave Rose her basic understanding of the proportions of the forces involved. In 1933, Rose Pesata first traveled to Los Angeles as an agent for the union to assist in the troubles workers were experiencing at the hands of savvy and powerful employers. Most of the women garment workers there were Mexican, the rest comprised of an amalgam of poor immigrants and locals, and despite having no other residences than their local ones and trying to raise families, they were largely regarded as migrant workers. Employers used every trick in the book to take advantage of the scarcity of work due to the Depression, and to squeeze workers to their own advantage. They would lay them off between orders, or make workers punch in and out throughout the day, between every batch of work. They would fire those who were known to be advocates for better conditions, or if they were known to have signed union cards, and actually blacklisted them so they couldn't get work anywhere else. Employers could also threaten them with deportation. The state minimum wage of $16 a week was simply ignored. Rose needed to reach out by ringing doorbells with the idea of striking for better conditions. But the people she needed to reach lived on the outskirts of town, in flimsy huts, without proper sanitation, heat, plumbing, or electricity, or doorbells. But she succeeded in organizing a strike, whose demands do not seem to us as exorbitant. She listed them in her book, Bread Upon the Waters. Union recognition, a 35-hour work week, a guaranteed minimum wage for each craft, regular union hours, 8:30 to 4:30 p.m. with an hour for lunch, a 5-day week, no take-home work, no worker to punch a time card except on actually entering or leaving the factory. By the time the strike was over, only some of these were met, including simply the observance of some items that were already law. Rose Pesata carried out effective work in San Francisco, Chicago, Cleveland, Seattle, Puerto Rico, Flint, Akron, Montreal, and Boston to address other similar situations. She developed a non-confrontational but eminently persuasive style, and she always remained a seamstress, returning to the workplace as a permanent rank-and-file companion of the workers for whom she battled. Rose Pesata was nominated and elected to the office of Vice President on the General Executive Board of the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union. The post was unsought and unwanted by her. but she was awed by the enormity of its significance and, although never wavering from her innate distrust of all officials, was duly sworn in as one and made the best of it. There were many sources of stress. More than once, organized labor and Posada herself crossed ideological swords with American communists who had their own ideas about organizing workers and who were known to undermine the efforts of unions to do their work in the way they thought best. Rose Posada had a strong and independent mind and was forever fighting the sexism and racism she encountered in her work, and she never ceased to stress the need to expand the education of women on a wide range of topics so as to help them realize their rights as workers, to realize and expand their career possibilities, and to promote and preserve their dignity as citizens. As the 30s progressed and conservatism crept into the officialdom of unions' bureaucracies, Posada continued to challenge the male domination of the organization. In 1944, she was sent again to Los Angeles to replace an indisposed head of the union's local chapter. After doing what she saw needed to be done, repercussions from that former union boss and his allies created a rift that could not be healed. As usual, infighting obscured the real cause of the work and instead brought about the demise of a stellar career in labor organizing. Rose Posada had saved thousands of jobs, improved working conditions for workers from coast to coast, and taught countless others on how to carry forward the work. For all her heroic efforts, and for remaining in the rank and file as well, Rose Posada knew where the true heroism of labor law lies. She wrote that to write a history of it, quote, "behind its growth in the face of political and economic vicissitudes, there would be revealed a legion of men and women, unheralded and unsung, rank-and-file people with natural ingenuity, strong working-class loyalty, readiness to sacrifice for an ideal, and all-around unselfishness," unquote. That's what it takes. Rose Posada died of cancer in Miami on December 7th, 1965. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, composer, and actor. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains, and I'm proud to call him my friend. Thank you for being part of 51%, Gilles. That's our show for this week. Thank you so much for being part of it. Thanks, as always, to the indefatigable Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1299. I'd like to leave you with something Margaret Mead said. Never believe that a few caring people can't change the world, for indeed, that's all who ever have. Tune in next week for another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.